This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, February 20th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Last night's Democratic presidential debate in Las Vegas was rowdier than usual, with the candidates tearing into each other rather than into Donald Trump.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against, a billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. Democrats are not going to win if we have a nominee who has a history of hiding his tax returns, of harassing women, and of supporting racist policies like redlining and stop and frisk. Look, I'll support whoever the Democratic nominee is. But understand this, Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another.
Bernie Sanders is still the front runner, even though moderate voters hate his Democratic socialist agenda and say he would lose to Trump. Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg are trying to push each other out of the moderate lane, and in any case, young progressive voters find them both unexciting. And they're all trying to destroy Michael Bloomberg for trying to buy the election and bury his racist stop and frisk policy as mayor of New York and his history of sexism. But what if the choice of nominee doesn't actually matter? That's a question asked by Rachel Bitticoffer, a political scientist at Christopher Newport University in Newport News, Virginia. In the polarized era, she told Politico magazine earlier this year, the outcome isn't really about the candidates. Instead, she says, it's about how to get voters activated. Bitticoffer's method of forecasting elections is unorthodox, but in some cases it has been surprisingly accurate. In July 2018, 5 months before the midterm elections, Bitticoffer used her forecasting model to predict that Democrats would pick up 42 seats in the House. In the end, they took 40. So what would it take to defeat Donald Trump? Rachel Bitticoffer joins me to discuss what Democrats have to be hopeful about and how they can improve their chances at the polls in November. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
So before we get to your ideas about 2020, let's talk about how you think the traditional understanding of U.S. politics has shifted over the last decade.
Yeah, so it has shifted significantly, and it's really been a surprise to me how much of a failure to adjust we've seen in the punditry, analyst, even the high-level, you know, silver 538 election analyst crowd, because I thought for sure, though, like Donald Trump broke every single rule of what should be possible in American politics to win the presidency. And so I thought after that happened, now people will catch on and that things have changed. But that adjustment never came.
And they began to change a very long time before Donald Trump arrived on the scene. Back in, I mean, would you agree that we first began to see it with the rise of the Tea Party in 2009 and 10?
Actually, our roots of these problems go all the way back. I mean, you could argue they go back to the beginning of the founding of the Republic and the original sin of America, which is slavery. But I really identify it to the transitions in the 50s and the 60s, not just with race and civil rights and the end of the Dixiecrats in the South, and but also women's rights and the cultural changes and the liberalization of immigration that actually opens it up to non-white immigrants. And but we start to see it, people look at the Gingrich Revolution in Congress as the beginning, right? But the public hangs in there for a long time, even prompting a well-renowned political scientist to disavow the idea of a polarized public in the mid-2000s. But if he had just waited a little bit longer, he would have seen this big, big divide opening up after 2008. And we have these two things happen, the election of a first black president and also the total destruction of the American economy. From that moment on, mass behavior changes, and yet it just seems that nobody else is accounting for that.
And why do you think pollsters and the mainstream media got it so wrong in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is this lack of appreciation for, you know, ultimately how polarization has increased the stakes of elections to voters. I mean, especially on the Republican side, the Republican audience, voter audience, is subjected for, has been subjected now for a couple of decades, not only to a media environment that has framed electoral stakes in terms of apocalyptic terms for them, where the opposition party is described as an enemy. You know, this has gotten worse and worse over the years. And then, you know, in addition to that, also our campaign industry, which in quite intentionally waged psychological warfare on the electorate to get them to behave in certain ways electorally, that ended up creating basically a Frankenstein problem.
So is that what you think was at work in the failure of the Clinton campaign?
Yeah, I mean, so that's on the Republican side. Primarily, the Democrats have been running the same playbook for about three or four decades and have really failed to adjust. Republicans, for at least the last decade, have been hyper-focused on the idea of base turnout or coalition turnout, getting people who will cast ballots for Republicans to the polls to show up, and using effective marketing and messaging techniques to do so. Whereas Democrats have not made that transition. They're still thinking about elections with this, what I call the mighty middle, people who are reasonable, who could be, you know, persuaded to go with the candidate that's most moderate and most, you know, digestible. And that's just not how the electorate is behaving anymore.
So you argue that this endless focus on the swing voter is just the wrong way to go.
Well, it's not even that. I mean, Democrats don't focus on the swing voter the way the Republicans focus on moderate voters. I mean, you never hear a Republican out on the stump trying to get Democrats to vote for him, right?
Yeah.
But that's a pretty stapled feature of like any moderate Democrats campaign, is trying to appeal to crossover voters. And the reason I mention that is that Democrats tend to campaign from a position of weakness and apology. So you'll often hear them talking about themselves termed in the other party's ideology rather than making an affirmative case for their own, you know, liberal economic platform. You'll hear moderates say instead, "I'm a fiscal conservative." And that says to voters who would be persuadable, you know, it's a small pool, but it does exist. It's not completely non-existent, but it says to them, hey, you know, you can have this guy who is a real thing of this product, or me, which is a fake version of the same product, and that to the voter who is persuadable, why go with an imitation when you can have the real thing?
Maybe you can help us solve the mystery of the white women who had voted twice for Barack Obama and then went for Trump. I just still haven't heard a persuasive explanation for that.
Yeah, I mean, let me back that out just a little bit and talk about the behavior of white women. I mean, there's obviously a well-known statistic from 2016, and that Donald Trump overwhelmingly carried the vote of white women, and that is a true statistic. But what has been overlooked is that, and this was a leading indicator for my research and my theory and my model, was that for the first time, white college-educated women broke from the Republican Party and voted majority in favor of the Democratic Party when they broke majority in favor of Hillary Clinton in 2016. And, you know, why is because college education has become this dividing line. For a long time, we've seen evidence that white college-educated voters were realigning away from the Republican Party as it embraced populism, Tea Party populism, and then Palinism, and now Trumpism and MAGA. But what you're going to find out is that the transition we're seeing in the suburbs is not predominantly powered by white college-educated voters changing their party allegiance. It is predominantly powered by millennial and Gen Z college-educated whites who are now, of course, 40. Millennials are 40, 30 years old. They are the homeowners in the suburbs with the children. They're going bald, right? And they were not participating robustly in politics until Donald Trump got elected, and now they are. And it has changed the partisan composition of those districts and those states in 2020, and we're going to really see how profoundly those turnout changes affected the partisan composition of those districts in that analysis.
And what about younger voters, college kids?
Yeah, those too. So we see this massive uptick in Gen Z voters. I mean, keep in mind, Generation Z is not fully enfranchised yet. When they are and they join millennials as fully enfranchised, here are a couple of basic facts to understand about them. Number one, they will number 160 million people in total. That is a lot of people. Number two, they are disproportionately Democratic and liberal-leaning. They are the most racially diverse generation in the history of the country, and they'll be the best educated generations in the country.
And will they come out to vote? That 160 million you're talking about, are they energized to go to the polls?
So it's not a fully enfranchised 160 million right now, but millennials are at that age now where they're starting to participate at very high rates. And yes, they're going to vote much higher than they did in 2016. It's going to have a dramatic effect on the election, and that was true if it's Bernie Sanders or, you know, Bloomberg on the ballot. But within the potential nominees and the tickets, there's room for improvement. And probably the most important thing for Democrats in turnout isn't ideologically based. It's actually descriptively based. Having a woman of color or a candidate of color somewhere on the ticket, and at this point it looks like that would have to be in the VP spot, I think is a tremendously important component of Democratic turnout.
But as I understand it, your models can't say which candidate would be strongest against Trump?
No, I mean, my model argues that all the candidates are strong against Trump. You know, it argues that Sanders is the riskiest pick, primarily, though, because of the party's disbelief that he's electable. And unlike the Republicans, the Democrats are not strategically talented. I mean, I often argue the Democratic Party, its apparatus, its organizations, both at the state and national level, are strategically inept. And the big danger of Sanders is that they fail to appreciate that they can win the election and fail to rally around him. So they cause basically the loss by failing to rally. And when my model dropped two races, one of them was the race in Nebraska, Nebraska's second district. And it was, according to my model, hot to trot on flipping over. But when a young progressive candidate ousted the party's mainstream, you know, kind of Joe Biden-like candidate of choice, the DCCC decided not to invest in the race because they figured, well, she's way too progressive to win, right? The old model, basically. And that was a major strategic mistake. Even without any resources or help from the party, she still got exactly the same amount of vote margin that a candidate in 2016 with full support of the party did. And, you know, if they had just simply supported her, they would have won that race as well. So when I say, like, they can cause themselves to lose by not rallying around Sanders, that's what I mean.
Yeah, and will this endless primary season and all the doomsaying within these factions of the Democratic Party weaken the eventual candidate in the general election? It's worrisome that while the field is, you know, slowly winnowing, Trump is just relentlessly building this fundraising machine and campaigning.
Yes, no, there's no doubt at all that this is a non-ideal situation for Democrats. And, you know, it's an atypical situation that we're in. I don't remember any contest in my lifetime in which we come out of the first couple of contests and don't have a two-person race, right? The potential for a brokered or contested convention seems high because Sanders is strong, but he's a plurality vote share winner, right? And he's only really going to be the front runner because there's too many mainstream candidates dividing up the other side of the vote. So we really are in a situation that's unprecedented in that regard. And I don't want to say there's no way that it could hurt the party. However, I will say that it in the old school world where polarization didn't exist, it would be a disaster. In the new school world in which America elected Donald Trump to the American presidency, I'm not so sure it's going to matter all that much.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You've predicted that the Democrats will gain House seats in 2020 and possibly even retake the Senate. So that's interesting. I want to hear you talk about that a little bit. And also your less accurate predictions in 2018 about the Senate, where you were more optimistic about Florida and possibly Texas and wrong about the Georgia governor's race.
Right. One of the things that I expected to see in 2018 was Republican voters doing what Democratic voters had done when Obama was in office. And getting Obama into office was the product or the end product of many years of Democratic angst and activism through the Bush years that had manifested in the 2006 House wave, where Democrats netted 30-something seats, took over control of the House, made Nancy Pelosi the Speaker, and then carried that momentum of opposition party angst to getting Obama elected president. And then what they did was they took their foot completely off the gas and they left Obama at the altar in 2010. And, you know, the way the media talks about those elections is about Obama overreach with the Obamacare reforms, which are very modest reforms to the healthcare system. But really what it is a story of the turnout collapse of the Democratic coalition, just across the board, young people, African Americans, just across the board. People just didn't bother to vote in those midterms. And the state legislative cycle, I mean, that's why he lost all those state, the Democrats lost all those state legislative races as well. And so I expected in 2018, we'll see this huge turnout bump from the Democrats and a subsequent decline in GOP turnout. But what I did not expect is that Donald Trump would be able to artificially inflate negative partisanship. So I'm sure the entire consultant world was aghast when Donald Trump announced he was going to hold rallies for the Senate candidates. The Senate candidates themselves probably wished that he didn't want to do that, and they certainly couldn't say no. And everybody was clucking their tongue at the strategy, except for me. I was saying, wow, this is going to probably work because he's firing up Republican voters and reminding them. I mean, he was literally saying to the voters in the audience, don't forget, this is a referendum on me, right? No president has ever said that about the midterm effect, right? But even with the wave at their back, even with disproportionately much larger turnout surges for Democrats, Republicans still outperform Democrats on turnout across the board. And that's why at the end of the day, those close elections in Florida and Texas and Georgia end up still breaking in favor of Republicans, because the decline I anticipated in Republican turnout did not manifest. And my modeling in 2020 takes into account that the Republican turnout is going to be fantastic.
And even with that, you feel confident that the Democrats will prevail?
I mean, there are certainly things that I'm looking for. So let's say that we continue to see this amazing turnout for Donald Trump in his primary, and then Democratic primary turnout is lackluster. I mean, there are certainly things that could happen that would make me alter my forecast, but my forecast is a fundamentals forecast. It's based on the demographic reality which within each of the states. So it's really not subject to a lot of to the ebb and flow that you're going to be following, listeners may be following every day on 538.
And what about fake news? You know, the party is understandably worried that voters will misunderstand what they're reading on social media and they will be influenced by it. And of course, that helped to get Trump elected in 2016.
Well, they should be, because this is going to be a major facet of the Brad Parscale GOP Trump campaign strategy. Parscale, of course, is Trump's campaign manager. His job is to turn a plurality president into a president again. Trump did not win in 2016 with a majority of the vote in most of the swing states. He won with a plurality. That was accomplished because of high rates of third-party voting, and they need as best as they can to recreate that scenario, because in case you haven't noticed, Donald Trump is not particularly popular. In fact, he's running for re-election as the least popular president to do so since Jimmy Carter, and he's doing it having been impeached. It's going to be an uphill battle, to say the least. So if I was running the Trump campaign, I'd be heavily focused on ways of bifurcating or trifurcating the not Trump vote in the electorate and trying to bring the winning vote margin in states like Wisconsin and Michigan below 50% like it was in 2016. And the way to do that is disinformation, propaganda, stuff like that. That's going to be heavily targeted at whoever loses this primary fight. And, you know, so if the Sanders people lose, I would expect they'll be heavily targeted with information that is aimed to get them to cast protest ballots for the Green Party or, just not show up to vote.
So final question. Given the current chaos and discouragement within the Democratic Party, what can Democrats right now, given this still very large field, what can they be doing to fire up these coalitions you're talking about? Presumably, once there is a nominee, it will be much easier going forward.
I mean, I think Democrats do a very terrible job at keeping their eyes on the prize and seeing the forest and not the trees. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly this primary is a great example of that. But when I dropped my model on July 1st of 2019, this was still way back in the invisible primary period. I understood that we'd be in this time period of a heightened competition in which there was no primary on the other side. So all the news was going to be focused entirely on Democratic infighting and scenes like last night, which was just an evisceration of each other on the stage. So, you know, these are things that are perfectly natural for presidential primaries, even though it seems like super existential right now to voters. It's not something, in other words, it's not something I didn't expect to see and didn't account for.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Bitticoffer is an election forecaster and analyst at the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C. You can read her article, Fear Factor, in the most recent issue of The New Republic. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.